It's the 14th of September 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. When debating with pro-lifers, just what sort of brick wall are you banging your head against? Could Christian Walmer improve London's transport, or is he off his trolley? Can a public apology ever be sincere if it has to pass through the mouth of Kelvin McKenzie? Why is a new EU website privacy law unenforceable, and is that just how the cookie crumbles? And why does Dan Dennett think that religion is natural? But first, the regular begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to poddelusion.co.uk and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. Also on our website, don't forget to buy tickets to our big event, which is happening on Saturday. That's tomorrow, if you're listening on the day of release. That's Saturday the 15th of September 2012, and it's taking place at Conway Hall in central London. Doors open at 7. You can buy tickets online up until a few hours before the event, or you can buy tickets on the door. Online, they're a fiver. On the door, £7. So do come along to that. As I've mentioned on previous weeks, the lineup includes Kate Russell from BBC Click, Martin Robbins from The Guardian, Alam Shahar, the author of The Young Atheist Handbook, but he'll be doing some magic and not talking about his book, and fire scientist Claire Benson, who will be starting fires on the listed building's wooden stage. So don't miss that. You can find links to buy tickets at poddelusion.co.uk. And now, let's get on with the show. Now, regular listeners will be familiar with our coverage of the protests against abortion clinics that have been, rather depressingly, cropping up increasingly in this country in what is the most irritating North American import since Nickelback. Last week, the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, BPAS, organised a public debate on the free speech issues surrounding the protests, with debaters including Anne Faridi, the chief executive of BPAS, and Andrea Williams, the chief executive of Christian Concern. And it was all chaired by friend of the show, David Alan Green. It was fun, if you're allowed to call a debate surrounding abortion fun. We hope to be putting up a podcast of the event shortly, as soon as we've secured all the relevant permissions and all that sort of thing. But anyway, afterwards I got a chance to speak to Anne Faridi to see how she thought it went, and why BPAS hosted the debate in the first place. I started by asking her what she hoped to achieve with the debate.
We've had people demonstrating outside our clinics, many clinics across the country, and it creates some real problems because on the one hand I think most of us are probably quite radical. We don't want to be infringing other people's right to freedom of expression, but on the other hand we are running a clinic that people are coming to for clinical care, so it's a balance between what's an acceptable way for people to protest. And so we thought it'd just be really good to have a very open, very honest discussion about the difficulties in balancing up the two things, the freedom to protest, the freedom to provide the service.
And obviously you're in a challenging position because you actually took a very, a relatively hardline sort of freedom of speech stance tonight, which surprised me, given that these people are being dicks outside of your clinic.
Well, you know, I feel like in some ways I'm such a lucky person because, as far as I'm concerned, I've got one of the greatest jobs I could possibly get, because what really drives me, what drives me politically and emotionally and socially, is a very strong belief in personal autonomy and people's ability to make choices about what they do. And to make choices about what you're going to do, you have to understand it and you have to be able to get behind the issues. So freedom of speech is a really, really important issue for me. And I kind of feel that on the one hand, one of the things that BPAS does within the law, obviously, but we can allow people to exercise their freedom of choice, which is a great position for me to be in. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that I leave behind my commitment to freedom of speech. So I'm constantly having to kind of think about the two things. And I think it fits together, because if you actually really believe that people should be able to do anything they want to do, as long as it doesn't harm another person, then actually taking the decision to end their unwanted pregnancy has got to be one of them. So I think the two things fit together.
I thought it was particularly interesting how you differentiated between freedom of speech, the debate, and also just harassing women outside of abortion.
Well, the point I was really trying to make is that freedom of speech The reason why we believe, I think, in freedom of speech is because we believe in freedom of expression. And that's not quite the same as saying you have the right to say anything at any time, at any place, to anyone. And I think that's a different thing. Freedom of speech is more than just saying stuff. It's about a broader form of expression, which is really about kind of challenging ideas or challenging people's moral stance. But, you know, the women who come to abortion clinics, they don't do so because they're making a moral stance that's pro-abortion or pro-choice even. They do it because they've got a problem. And actually, a lot of them will not be pro-choice, and that's okay. They're making their own choice for themselves.
Excellent. And it was a very spirited debate, to say the least. Do you think any minds were changed?
I'm not sure that minds would have been changed on abortion, because I think the people who walked into this room probably knew exactly where they stood on that. I think probably some of the discussion about freedom of expression, freedom of speech, maybe people have had to think a little bit more about stuff that they hadn't quite thought about before. I know I have. I don't think I've changed where I'm coming from on it, but it was a really good discussion from that point of view.
Excellent. We'll leave it there, Anthony. Thank you
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Brilliant. So as I said before, the debate was supposed to be about the free speech issues, though Andrea Williams seemed to miss the memo and instead, as her opening gambit, showed us a really graphic video of an abortion, and then later asked why all women getting abortions don't get an ultrasound scan, only for Anne Faridi to tell her that they actually do. Which is interesting, as ultrasounds are a particularly contentious issue in abortion, not just here, but back in America as well, as Trish Han wants to explain in this next piece.
I want to begin this piece by first telling you what it's not about. It's not about whether abortion is right or wrong, and it's not about whether the tactics used by protesters on either side are ethical or okay. What I would like to talk about is a particular part of the process which has caused some debate and controversy, even though it appears that many people are unaware of the facts. Recently, some US states have started to enforce laws which mean that every woman who wants to terminate her pregnancy must first undergo a transvaginal ultrasound. If you speculate as to the motives of the conservative lawmakers, it could be argued that this is taking things too far. But every counter-argument I've heard has picked out the wrong points and been based on emotion rather than medicine. So, the first point I would like to make is that in the UK, clinics such as those run by Marie Stopes and BPAS routinely perform ultrasound examinations as part of the initial consultation process. Some of those who oppose abortion seem to believe that this doesn't happen. In fact, some seem to think that you're whisked into a cubicle as soon as you're over the threshold and fetus free within the hour whether you like it or not. The reality is this. Pregnancy can be complicated. Really complicated. An ultrasound scan is used to determine the size and gestational age of the fetus, something which is hugely important as it affects the type of procedure necessary to terminate the pregnancy. And the later the pregnancy, the higher the risks. It's all very well asking the woman when she thinks she got pregnant, but it's entirely possible that she doesn't know for sure. In these cases, an accurate measurement is very necessary. It's also entirely possible, though unlikely, that she isn't even pregnant. Shop-bought tests aren't great, and even the best urine test can be fooled by hormones. In fact, there are even tumours which release the pregnancy hormone, so a blood test could also turn out to be incorrect. Plus, early stage pregnancies are hugely vulnerable. Women miscarry in the first trimester all the time, some without even knowing. In these cases, an abortion is no longer required, and the patient can be referred to a gynaecologist to make sure that she has no underlying health condition which caused the miscarriage. Okay, so this patient is 100% certain she conceived 6 weeks and 3 days ago. Great, but that's not all the information needed to perform a safe termination. If the pregnancy is ectopic, it has to be treated differently, as a woman's life could be at risk. Similarly, the woman may still be undecided as to whether she wishes to continue with a pregnancy. These clinics exist to provide advice as well as abortions, and the vast majority of ectopic pregnancies are unviable, meaning that the clinic can intervene as early as possible, thereby minimising the chances of internal hemorrhaging. It's unpleasant that in these cases the decision is effectively removed from the hands of the patient, but it's unlikely that she would prefer to die instead. So the patient is pregnant, it's not ectopic, and she definitely wants a termination. But what's that? Two gestational sacs? Good job that was spotted on the ultrasound, rather than discovered during the surgical procedure, so the clinicians were able to repair and minimise the risk to the patient. So yeah, pregnancy isn't always straightforward. There are even things called molar pregnancies, which are unviable growths which implant into the uterine wall. Doctors tend to like knowing what they're up against before starting a procedure. Crazy, I know. I'd also just like to add at this point that abnormalities such as these may be rare, but patients don't tend to care how unique they are when they're violently hemorrhaging. So I'd like to think I've put forward a fairly good case for performing an ultrasound examination prior to terminating a pregnancy. But one complaint I've heard from the pro-choice crowd is that a transvaginal examination is tantamount to rape. Quite frankly, this view is disturbing and offensive, and I don't feel that I need to explain why, but I will explain why a transvaginal examination is preferable to a transabdominal one. Sonography relies on a piezoelectric effect to emit ultrasonic waves into the body, which are then picked up by the transducer and translated into a visual image on the screen. It's non-ionising, very low risk, and it's used in a wide variety of diagnostic situations. Personally, I've been trained to use it in trauma situations to check for internal hemorrhaging, but it's also used to visualise muscles, ligaments, internal and superficial organs, and we use it in biopsies. It's pretty clever. We can use colour Doppler to check blood flow, but it can be easily scuppered by something as simple as an empty bladder. A transabdominal ultrasound examination involves sending the sound waves through many layers of tissue, skin, fat, muscle, bowel, bladder, and this reduces the resolution of the images that are produced. A transabdominal scan can be used to determine pregnancy beyond a certain stage, but not necessarily in early gestation, and abnormalities can be nearly impossible to spot this way. Quite simply, a transvaginal ultrasound examination is of a much higher diagnostic quality. Yes, some women will probably find it traumatic, especially those who have been victims of sexual violence, but that doesn't change the importance of the examination. All patients are treated as individuals, and their circumstances and needs are taken into account. Sedation can be offered to those who need it, and women who just find the whole thing unpleasant will be given positioning and breathing instructions from sonographers who perform these examinations all the time. Some women find it easier to manage if they insert the transducer probe themselves. It's only the width of your thumb, and plenty of lubrication is used, so it's hardly as brutal as some have made it out to be. There are going to be some patients who are simply unable to undergo the examination, and that's fine. The clinicians will usually find a workaround. But that doesn't mean that the women who do undergo it have been medically raped. That's a gross exaggeration, which undermines the pro-choice argument as far as I'm concerned. Some US states are apparently trying to pass laws which mean that all women seeking to terminate their pregnancies must hear the fetal heartbeat and see the images produced during their scan. If this genuinely is the case, and the intention is to guilt-trip them into a forced pregnancy, then yeah, I'll concede that it's pretty sick, even though it's unlikely to change any decisions the women make. Some women may explicitly wish to view the images purely out of curiosity. It might be the only diagnostic imaging they ever experience, and they might actually be quite interested in what's going on with their bodies. That's the funny thing with us women. We're not all vulnerable gibbering wrecks unable to make our own choices without a man or the man interfering. Some will prefer to be as detached as possible, as it may help them cope with the situation. Equally, others, whilst completely wishing to go ahead with the termination, will be leaving smudgy fingerprints all over the screen as they ask the sonographer for a labelled diagram of their insides. So whilst the anti-abortion crowd are sure that transvaginal ultrasound examinations will save lives, and the pro-choice crowd are certain that lives will be ruined, I would personally just like everyone to stop calling sonographers rapists, because it's reactionary and insulting. Thanks. This is Trish Han, still recovering from Tuesday's BPAS debate, for The Pod Delusion.
Now, in the past, this podcast has been accused of being a bit London-centric, which is something I don't really understand because, as far as I can tell, London really is the centre of the universe. Why else would the M25 go around it? Anyway, here in London, as we approach the end of Boris's second term of mayor, which began in May 2012, the Labour Party are already looking forward to 2016, because, let's face it, thinking about the present isn't going to make them very happy. As Ken Livingstone won't be standing for election, they'll need to actually have a contested election within their party, and one man has already put himself forward. Christian Wolmar is an author, historian and a journalist who has written for years about transport issues, and this week he declared his candidacy for the Labour nomination. He has some intriguing ideas and doesn't strike me as a man who'll get stuck on a zipline, so to find out more, we got in touch. I started by asking him what made him want to take the step into politics.
Well, I've been writing about transport for 20 years, so I have picked up a bit about it. And the mayoralty is, you know, about 50-60% to do with transport, and then a few others, issues like policing and housing, of which I have an interest as well. But I can see that, you know, neither Ken, certainly after the first couple of years, nor Boris has really tried anything very interesting in terms of transport. All they're doing is saying, well, we need to accommodate a bit more. We'll do a little bit on cycling. We'll do a little bit about this. And Boris was obsessed with getting rid of the bendy buses. And, you know, Ken wanted to reduce the fares. But nobody's saying, hey, look, you know, the transport system we have is pretty good, but gosh, it could be so much better if, for example, we began to, you know, limit or discourage cars from coming into central London, which causes chaos. You know, if we invested in, you know, better facilities for walking and cycling, you know, if we, you know, continued to expand the bus service, if we really made it possible to use that instead of cars, if we maybe put in some tram systems, even trolley buses, which is kind of cheap version of trams in outer London, particularly where I think they would be popular, like the Croydon thing, we could really do something. But it needs a vision. It needs people, somebody at the centre saying, look, this can change. It doesn't have to be like this. Now, look what's happening in, for example, Paris, where, you know, the mayor is closing part of what is really a kind of urban motorway along the Seine and turning it into a public area. And you know, it's that sort of thinking. And oddly enough, Richard Rogers had that idea in London some years ago, back in 1986, and of course nothing came of it.
So how will your ideas and your vision sort of manifest? I mean, have you any ideas yet what we can expect to see in terms of for cyclists? Are you going to be closing off big roads? Do you have any ideas of exactly where yet or anything like that?
Well, yes, there's you know, a campaign by the London Cycling campaign of Go Dutch, and the idea there is to have, you know, two or three areas which are emblematic and show what a difference you can make. One of them is Parliament Square, which for some time Ken did have the idea of semi-pedestrianising, opening it up, and then that got abandoned. And Parliament Square is really a ghastly sort of, you know, roundabout, and it's a, you know, absolutely key area for tourists and visitors. You can get rid of gyratory systems for outer London, you know, which cause, you know, which encourage traffic to go faster and make it more difficult for cyclists. You can create you know, real cycle superhighways. You know, Boris has put in these superhighways. I've ridden along several of them, and quite recently I've gone to the Olympic Park recently a few times. And, you know, it's supposed to be a superhighway, but all it is a bit of blue paint, which occasionally becomes red and then goes into another colour blue, and really doesn't add very much at all to cycling facilities. So, you know, you really have to say, look, let's do something serious for cyclists. Let's really make a difference, rather than just tinkering about the edges and saying, well, we have to accommodate everybody and we can't, you know, delay the traffic flow, which is the philosophy that Boris has.
How do we actually make that space then? Because London has some rather narrow streets. I mean, how do we keep the cars out? Is this just, you know, more congestion charging?
Look, essentially, I think you need a better targeted congestion charge. So there's a very crude technology, you know, one zone that you go in and out of. You know, we've got to move towards something more sophisticated, maybe eventually a zone for the whole of London. That might be something that eventually certainly needs looking at. But, you know, the key is to set some targets about how to reduce car use, and then look at all the measures you can implement to do that, which is, you know, closing off some streets, closing off turnings. Look what happened in the Olympics. You know, that's precisely what happened. You know, they made a decision, we want these to be the public sector games, and we don't, the public transport games, and, you know, we don't want people to jump in their cars and drive to Stratford. And, you know, we will actually take away some of the road network for the officials' cars and so on. And what happened? We all managed to get around. The traffic, to a large extent, continued smoothly. And, you know, people did change their travelling habits, and they did travel in their droves by public transport, and it worked. So it does show you can do really big things.
Do you think we can take that and carry it on, though? Because maybe everyone was just scared by the Olympics and thought, oh, it'll be fine in 4 weeks' time, it'll be back to normal. Do you think we can make this a permanent thing?
No, absolutely. You can make that sort of idea permanent. What I think that shows is the way forward. Of course, the detail, you know, has to be looked at carefully. You have to make the right decisions about what roads to close, what left turns to block, which streets to put extra bus lanes in, and so on. But you know the fact that there was this big idea of, you know, let's make these the public transport games, and then, you know, working towards a whole series of objectives that fitted in with that strategy. That's the key lesson from it. Of course, I don't have every possible detail about what to do, but you know, you worked on an overall vision and you get there.
It sounds like a, you know, I quite like your vision. I'm a recent convert to cycling, so I'm obviously looking out for improvements to cycling now and stuff. And I'm thinking politically, do you think you can make this all happen? Can you build the support in the Labour Party to get the nomination? And once you're there, do you think you'll be able to stand up against, you know, the motoring lobby and, you know, the Jeremy Clarkson types?
Yeah, look, obviously, you know, it's something of an uphill task. But yes, I think you can use that example at the Olympics particularly. But you can begin to change public opinion. My aim in standing is twofold. I mean, one is because I actually want to get there and win the nomination and become mayor. But the other is, at least, you know, as the consolation prize, I'll have put these ideas out there. You know, I started off with a, you know, half page piece in The Times, which wouldn't have been there otherwise, and get these ideas discussed. And by throwing my hat in early, I think I've, you know, got a chance of pushing the Labour Party to at least accept that these ideas must be discussed and not just rejected as some sort of, you know, extreme green agenda and you know, absolutely unworkable. And some people in the Labour Party have told me that. They've encouraged me to stand on the basis that, you know, at least we're going to have a proper debate, unlike last time when, you know, Ken just got the nomination, you know, with very little discussion.
We've put links to find out more on that sort of thing on the Pod Delusion website. Now, apologies. Not from me, of course, but from, well, quite a few other people in the last few weeks, if the news is anything to go by. This week, Alex Fitch has been taking a look at the phenomenon of the public apology.
The news over the last week has been punctuated a lot with apologies. Apologies for disasters, and people's responses to those apologies. As we come out of the Paralympic Games and start to consider whether the event will have a lasting effect on the lives of disabled people in this country, the first inappropriate apology came when, during the Paralympics, German company Chemie Gruenthal decided that 50 years after the first thalidomide babies were born, now would be the best time to comment. The timing seems particularly cynical, as if they thought they could cash in on the wave of celebration and that their meagre-mouthed statement would be accepted and brushed under the carpet. Harald Stock, Gruenthal chief executive, said, "We ask for forgiveness that for nearly 50 years we didn't find a way of reaching out to you from human being to human being," and added, "We ask that you regard our long silence as a sign of the shock that your fate caused in us." In response, Fred Astbury, head consultant of Thalidomide Agency UK, said, "If they are serious about admitting they're at fault and regret what happened, they need to start helping those of us who were affected financially. Being disabled is very expensive, and thalidomide people need help and care and adaptations to their cares and homes." And obviously his words reflect something that is becoming more and more important as the survivors get older and no longer have parents to look after them. Having started a meagre ball rolling, hopefully the company will, as Mr. Asprey summed up, put their money where their mouth is. Another apology this month has come from Prime Minister David Cameron, in the long shadow of another 20th century disaster, the deaths of 96 people following overcrowding at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield on the 15th of April 1989. A year after the deaths, the Taylor inquiry announced that the main reason for the disaster was the failure of police control, as there was a lack of police presence in the stadium, leading to around 3,000 people being directed to an area of the stands designed for two-thirds of that number. However, it has taken another 19 years for all the evidence to be released to the public, and a further 3 years for the 2009 Hillsborough Independent Panel to comment on the thousands of pages of evidence. The panel's report states that police made strenuous attempts to erroneously blame the disaster on fans drinking or illegally entering the ground without tickets. David Cameron has responded to this by saying that on behalf of the UK government, then and now, he wants to give a profound apology to the grieving relatives who have waited over two decades to hear a full account of what happened. Families of Hillsborough survivors seem to be accepting Cameron's apology. However, another apology that was rejected this month belonged to Kelvin McKenzie, then editor of The Sun, who on September the 12th, 2012 said, "Today I offer my profuse apologies to the people of Liverpool for that headline. I too was totally misled." The headline he's referring to being a heartless, tactless, inaccurate one based on misinformation that wasn't properly researched and appeared on page one of The Sun on April the 19th, 1989, which read, "The truth. Some fans picked pockets of victims. Some fans urinated on the brave cops. Some fans beat up PC giving kiss of life." Trevor Hicks, chairman of the Hillsborough Family Support Group, has unsurprisingly rejected Mr. McKenzie's apology as too little too late, calling him a lowlife. Relatives of Hillsborough victims are still waiting to see what action will be taken against the police for the disaster in 1989, with Sir Norman Betterson, the Chief Constable of West Yorkshire Police at the time of this podcast, still unbelievably refusing to admit any culpability, as Trevor Hicks and others are calling for his resignation. The thalidomide scandal and the continuing attempts of Hillsborough survivors to discover the full truth of police failings and avoidance of blame have been in the media on and off in the intervening years. One film in particular, Hillsborough by Jimmy McGovern, which highlighted the continuing plight of the stadium disaster's survivors and families in a well-rounded and well-researched way, was shown in 1996, 98 and 2009, with another TV screening imminent to coincide with the release of the latest report. This film is one of a handful that examines the facts of tragedies in a sensitive way. Unfortunately for every good film, there are a dozen blockbusters that sensationalise tragedies, such as James Cameron's re-released Titanic, now on Blu-ray, which tells a hackneyed upstairs-downstairs love story against a disaster that killed over 1,500 people. But hey, doesn't that look good when you spend $200 million on it, especially now you can see it in 3D? More tasteless still are films that cash in on tragedies before even the dust has settled. Last month, Anders Behring Breivik was sentenced to 21 years for the 77 murders he committed in Norway on the 22nd of July 2011. This was the largest and most horrific attack on the people of Norway since the Second World War. In October 2011, a trailer for a film about the Utøya Island massacre appeared on YouTube from hack director Vitaly Versace. It's easy to tell from the footage in this trailer, and the additional footage in a second added on May 2012, that this ultra-low-budget film was intended to be tasteless and a cheap cash-in. It's not without precedent, even from the director himself, as he also made a trailer for a movie about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, which took place in the Gulf of Mexico in spring and summer 2010, killing 11 people and injuring 17 in the initial explosion, and led to the deaths of nearly 7,000 animals. A trailer for Versace's movie Oil Spill appeared online in July 2010, over 2 months before the Deepwater leak was finally capped. So his sensitivities in making films about ongoing tragedies were already quantified. It's hard to tell if Versace finished this film, as the IMDb only lists his 2010 horror films Deception and The Last Vampire on Earth as extant. But the recent trailer for Utøya Island suggests that he's pursuing the completion of this one, perhaps waiting until the trial of Anders Breivik to shoot its final scenes. While there have been angry responses to the trailers on YouTube, it's surprising that there hasn't been a bigger backlash against these cheap and tasteless cash-ins. To show that I don't have complete disdain for the Sun newspaper, I'm happy to thank and credit one of their trainee reporters, Ben Cusack, for getting in touch to point out the existence of the Utoya Island film and transcribing for me a video response that the director gave to criticism of the trailer, in which Versace says, "The United States don't even know what happened in Norway, so as a filmmaker, I thought I should show the world what happened and what we could probably stop if we stopped selling guns to retarded people. Also, police have sent me emails from Norway. Guys, I'm in the United States. I don't care what's happening in your department." So no apology from Versace. And one can only hope that he never gets a career beyond the Z-grade films he currently makes, which, based on the evidence so far, seems likely. One final invective to rabble-rousing media this week comes again from the other side of the Atlantic, in response to another offensive trailer for an anti-Islamic film called The Innocence of Muslims, which portrays the Prophet Muhammad as a womanizer and promoter of child abuse. This trailer has been online for a year and was partially bankrolled by an Islamophobic Christian pastor, Terry Jones, who previously encouraged parishioners to burn copies of the Quran. However, it was its translation into an Arabic language that led to Middle Eastern awareness of its existence on YouTube. Riots and violence broke out at the US embassies in Egypt and Libya on September the 11th, a politically charged date for American-Muslim relations, leading to the deaths of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other officials, with smouldering vehicles in the surrounding area from grenade attacks. The various responses to this have been additionally politicized. The embassy in Cairo released the following statement, condemning the continuing efforts by misguided individuals to hurt the religious feelings of Muslims, as we condemn efforts to offend believers of all religions, which led to presidential hopeful Mitt Romney saying, "It's disgraceful that the Obama administration's first response was not to condemn attacks on our diplomatic missions, but to sympathize with those who waged the attacks." This, however, has led to a backlash against Mitt for trying to use the situation to his advantage, and shows that his potential foreign policy might fan the flames of such a situation further. As an outside observer to media intervention and responses to all kinds of recent tragedies, one's response has to be sympathetic to as many people as possible, and to try and find a moral approach to each event. It seems easy to see a degree of cynicism and lack of empathy from Shemi Gruenthal to the thalidomide survivors, and of the same from Kevin McKelsey and The Sun at the time of the Hillsborough disaster, and even the police today regarding the deaths in Sheffield. Filmmaker Vitaly Versace and his cast, who apparently found the making of a film about the Utoya massacre hilarious when interviewed in making-of segments, should be further condemned for cashing in on tragedy. However, with this film, if it ever gets finished, and the Islamophobic trailer, we have to then debate censorship, removal of material from the internet, which has happened regarding the latter on at least YouTube sites in the Middle East, and what to do with inflammatory material. In terms of such material that may lead to condemnation and violence in the Muslim world, banning something like The Innocence of Muslims seems like a no-brainer. But then that leads to a slippery slope, where you have to consider the response to the work of director Theo van Gogh, murdered for making a film criticizing treatment of women in Islam, and the Danish cartoonists that drew images of Muhammad in 2005 in a way that offended many Muslims and again provoked at least 100 killings and violence, including attacks on the Danish embassies in Pakistan, Syria, Lebanon and Iran. Many liberal commentators see Van Gogh as having a legitimate point to make and the Danish cartoonists as being relatively innocuous. That's not a debate I want to get into here. But all of these events show that we live in a world where tragic deaths do have to be responded to by the media conscientiously, and people need to take greater responsibility for their dissemination of images and films in an ever-interconnected world. While we gradually take on board those responsibilities, a genuine and heartfelt apology still goes a long way. This has been Alex Fitch for The Pod Delusion.
Now, you may have heard about a stupid new European law surrounding cookies. You know, the little files that websites use to remember exactly who you are. The law means that you must be prompted when you get to a website to ask if you're willing to accept cookies. Maybe that's why Eric Pickles' computer is such a privacy nightmare. But anyway, it's all a bit silly, and a new website has appeared protesting the law and sending out a challenge to the people who enforce it, as Salim Fadley now explains.
This week, Dale Evans, a spokesman for the Information Commissioner's Office, suggested that his department would be likely to pursue enforcement action against website operators that have failed to comply with the cookie warning deadline. He's referring to the European e-privacy directive, which became effective this summer. This directive mandates that all websites that make use of a commonplace web technology called cookies should display a sort of consent form. In theory, violators, people who don't display such a form, can face fines of up to £500,000. You may have noticed these cookie warnings popping up on websites. Warning, this site uses cookies. Please click on a button if you're okay with this. That sort of thing. Often these buttons pop up at inconvenient times, such as when you browse a website via your mobile phone. But more usually, they're completely ignored by users. I spoke with Oliver Emberton from the company Silktide, who, despite making a tool which helps website owners comply with European laws, has begun a campaign to protest this law. I began by asking why it is that a company whose raison d'etre is to help people comply with technical and legal standards has decided to protest this law.
Basically, we're protesting it because it's a bad law. The law's a poor solution to a genuine problem. You've probably noticed all of those pop-ups and banners you're seeing on the internet. Not many people, in our experience, are actually getting anything out of that. They're getting maybe a little annoyed, or maybe they're just choosing to ignore those banners. Website owners are having to put quite a bit of effort into trying to comply with this law, but it's not actually suddenly enhancing the privacy of users in any meaningful way. You've just got a load of extra bureaucracy. You've got a potential threat to business where people are being told they can be fined up to £500,000 in the UK if they fail to comply with this law. So there's this kind of spectre of legislation, but there's no actual benefit to users.
These cookie alert pop-ups are not very informative, are they? They're just little dialogue boxes which say, this site uses cookies, do we have your consent to continue? And the average user isn't really going to know what on earth this means. Can you explain what exactly these cookie things are?
Okay, well, a good analogy I've heard is that a cookie is a little like a laundry ticket. So when you visit a website, the website may assign the browser, the computer you're using, a number, like a laundry ticket. And then as you view other pages on that website, your computer kind of hands back this ticket and says, hey, it's me again. And based on that information, the website is able to do things, like essentially recognize your computer between separate web pages. And this sounds really basic. Without a cookie, a website couldn't know that you went from one web page to another. So it couldn't do really common things like, I don't know, let you log in or add something to your basket, because it simply wouldn't know who you are between separate web pages.
It's something we take for granted, isn't it?
Absolutely.
A website knows who you are from one click to the next. But without these cookies, that wouldn't be possible, or at least it might be possible, but it would be very difficult for the average developer to do this quite commonplace thing.
95% of websites currently use cookies. There are potentially alternative technologies, but essentially they would all fall under this law anyway, so it makes no real difference. It is necessary, for completely benign reasons, to remember that a computer is viewing one web page and another and then another, to do things we take for granted.
So let's talk a little bit about this law. The European directive mandates that all users need to opt in to allowing cookies to be received from a website. But surely I've already been opting into receiving cookies as a consequence of not disabling this feature in my web browser. That's a toggle button that web browsers have had for more than a decade. So why is it that the legislators feel that we need these pop-ups when arguably we didn't even need this legislation in the first place?
I'm going to half side with legislation for a second. I understand where they're coming from. Most users don't really know what cookies are, and they don't generally understand the privacy implications of using the internet. So the idea of this law is they're basically saying, look, it's not good enough that people have implicitly opted in. We need to tell them that they've opted in. In fact, we actually need them to give their consent. Now, I can see why they're doing this. It's from the most noble purpose, but unfortunately, it doesn't really understand the nature of the internet.
It seems like a simple enough solution, though, popping up a dialogue box to ask users for consent as to whether you're allowed to use cookies. And then if they say yes, we send a cookie. What's actually wrong with this solution from a technical point of view?
Let me give you an analogy. Imagine you're visiting a supermarket, and every time you visit the supermarket, there's a new law that says, as you go into the supermarket, you have to maybe check a box, sign a form, something like that, to go into the supermarket. So you can just imagine waiting outside a store, filling in a form, whatever, ticking it off and going inside. And the reason that this would be introduced is because you may be monitored when you're in the store. You know, there may be security staff looking at you. There may be a loyalty card when you go to the checkout, etc. Now, the problem with this law is basically, although in this hypothetical law would help users with their privacy, it would also enormously frustrate those customers and also inhibit those businesses. So you'd have the businesses who are actually trying to comply would just be annoying their customers. The customers wouldn't really be helped.
That responsible businesses have an interest in making sure that their customers are not unduly annoyed by abusing their privacy. And on the other hand, irresponsible businesses probably won't be implementing these pop-ups anyway. So there's a sort of, it creates a misleading impression, a false sense of security, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You have the obvious problem. There are majority of websites that people rely on, say Facebook or Google and what have you, are generally not based in the EU. And therefore, they don't fall under this law. And therefore, for the most part, you could be using these websites thinking perhaps that you're safe because there's no messages. In reality, of course, you're not. And of course, as you say, the kind of the evildoers, the people who would genuinely abuse your privacy, are not really inclined to go out of their way to comply with this law.
That's a good point, because I may unknowingly be an infringer, because I've built maybe tens or 20 or so WordPress-based websites, and there's a whole bunch of them which are obsolete software versions that I haven't bothered to update. Every single one of those sites is probably infringing now, potentially making me liable to a £500,000 fine.
Absolutely. Well, the question has to be asked, are you really a priority? Is that infringement or so-called infringement a genuine threat to users of the internet or indeed anyone in your website?
I was just browsing your website, silktide.com, and I noticed that there's no cookie warning, which is especially odd, as I said, since your company makes a cookie compliance product. Are you going to put one on your site in the next few days?
No, we actually made a solution for free, have given it away. It's probably the most popular solution to this law in the world right now. And we've specifically taken it off our website because since this law has come into effect, it's basically been proven to be ridiculous. No one is really complying. There's no enforcement of the law. The pitiful attempts for the few people who are complying to comply do nothing for users. And we basically dared the government last week to come after us. We said, we're taking the solutions off. We dare you to do anything about it. And we got featured by BBC News and loads, tons of press. And they basically came back and said, yeah, that's fine. But their actual words were well done.
Just for a laugh, I'm going to use Oliver's product, Silktide, to check whether poddelusion.co.uk complies with the European e-privacy directive. So I'm just going to type in poddelusion.co.uk, and that's the website where you can find links to Oliver's protest and also the tool for checking compliance. And I'm just going to submit, and it's checking our site now. Oh, here's the result. And James, do you think we have a spare £500,000?
Not yet, but you can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, some celebrity news. Now, everyone knows that celebrities are better than us. That's why when they say jump, we say how high. And when they say everyone go and attack that person on Twitter, invariably their fans will launch a relentless attack on some poor kid who sent an arsey tweet to a millionaire. Maybe that's where dystopian sci-fi went wrong. In the future, it won't be governments or corporations oppressing us in the lawless hellscape, but former Mock the Week contestants instead. A blog posted the rounds this week focusing on this phenomenon, and it made Twitter seem less a lovely, friendly place where we moan about trains, but a rather unpleasant place indeed. To find out more, here's Tom Williamson.
I'm joined today by Neil Kennedy from the Cooked and Bombed Comedy Forum and comedychat.co.uk podcast and blog, and we're going to be talking about celebrity bullying on Twitter. Neil, hello.
Hello, nice to meet you, Tom.
So bullying on Twitter, I mean, why do you think it's a problem, and can you give us a bit of backstory as to how you got into it?
Well, I think bullying is always a problem, no matter where it occurs, and I think it's something that should be tackled, and people should be trying to shine a light on it. And what we hear a lot about these days in the media is so-called bullying by trolls and haters. And what we don't really hear is that celebrities can be bullies as well, and what they can do is use their enormous social networking clout to target people who criticize them or annoy them in some way. And I have watched this for the last couple of years that I've been on Twitter, and I've observed this happening, and I'm just sick of it. It got to a very serious crux. It got to a very serious sort of situation last week where someone seemed to try to commit suicide because of being the target of one of these campaigns. And I just felt that I had to speak out about it and try and make people aware of the consequences of what they were doing.
So in your opinion, who were the worst offenders?
Well, the most frequent offender, certainly, I would say, is Ricky Gervais, who does it constantly. And that's no surprise because I think his comedy is associated with a type of bullying. And, I mean, frequently you can see that. He likes to really sort of dig down at people that are beneath him, apart from something like the Golden Globes, which I, you know, agree with. I always think comedy should be punching up. I think it has a responsibility to hold the powerful to account. I don't think comedians should be picking on those who are less able to defend themselves. And I think that is something that can be transferred to something like Twitter. It should be the same thing. They shouldn't be picking on people that really are not able to defend themselves. And so I would say Ricky Gervais does it frequently. Almost every day he does it, I've seen on Twitter. And recently, I would say Noel Fielding as well. He's been pretty obnoxious. Simon Pegg has done it in the past. That's covered in the blog, but he's subsequently apologized for it, and very graciously so. So I think he's reformed there. I've heard other stuff about people like Graham Linehan and Alan Davies. And I mean, everyone has a story. Everyone has a story about, you know, these comedians doing this. And not just comedians, but people in the wider sort of celebrity world.
So do you think some celebrities don't realize what they're doing?
I think definitely. They don't consider the responsibility that they have. They don't consider the consequences. And what we just talked about was the most horrific consequence, because this woman tried to commit suicide because she was the target of some bullying. And I don't think that's, you know, necessarily always going to happen. That's something. I mean, suicide is a personal choice. You can't lay all the blame on someone like Noel Fielding. That's something that someone does. But this is the end result of bullying. This is what can happen. We know that. We know this over and over again, that people who are kids that are bullied on Facebook can go and commit suicide. And my concern is that these are people like Noel Fielding are highly respected and put on a pedestal by their fans. And he is endorsing bullying to young children. And I find that horrendous, absolutely horrendous.
Do you think that we're mostly dealing with trolls here?
My problem with the term troll is that, and haters as well now, is that it's the parameters for it have become so wide that it basically just means anyone who disagrees with you. And or it can mean anyone who criticizes a celebrity, anyone who criticizes a TV show, anyone who's prepared to stand up for themselves, anyone who argues in a robust manner. So undoubtedly, some of these people are classically trolls, and they're trying to evoke an emotional response. So you've got to ask them, therefore, why are they being given an emotional response? They should be ignored, and they shouldn't be given what they want. That's the most effective way to respond, is to just ignore this kind of thing.
Are there any celebrities who are particularly good at dealing with trolls?
Yeah, I've noticed. I pick out Charlie Brooker in the blog because I've noticed this for a while now. He knows that he has a lot of fans. I mean, I think he's 500,000 followers, and a lot of those fans are very attached to him. And because you know what fandom's like, you know, and especially with a network like Twitter, where you can sort of feel that you're friends with these people just because maybe they reply to you or because they're in your timeline every day. And you know, everyone wants to be friends with these celebrities. And so what he does, and I've seen Richard Herring doing this as well recently, if there is something that's sent to him that is critical and it's something that he can use for comedy purposes, he will retweet it but redact the username so that it doesn't get sent out to his followers, and then they have no one to attack, which I think is a really classy way of doing it. Otherwise, you know, he'll have – I've looked on his timeline before, and I've seen him have – just like one-on-one chats with people who have disagreed with him. He's reluctant to block them. He tries to engage them in conversation. And then I think I've went back later and noticed that he's deleted the whole thing from his timeline just in case anyone's hovering over and decides to pick a fight on his behalf, because that's what we're dealing with, is people trying to fight on their behalf and sometimes being shepherded into that by people like Ricky Gervais and No Feeling.
Do you think there's any merit in the saying, don't feed the trolls?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that exists because that's the perfect response. You're dealing with people who want an emotional response, so you don't give them one. You know, you just, if they want attention, if they want negative attention, then the worst thing you can do is give them it. And so just, yeah, don't feed the trolls. It's hard. It's difficult not to. But ultimately, I think it's a better path is just to block them and move on.
Mm-hmm.
If that's your preferred method. I like to try and discuss things with people, but I know that it's just impossible at times. Some people don't want a discussion. Some people just want to be angry. And if you're dealing with someone who has millions of followers as well, just it's impossible to deal with all those people. But also, it's impossible to block all the critics, but it's also impossible to punish them all. So why are you doing it? I mean, someone like Ricky Gervais talks about it as being a form of self-defense. He talks about it as being like as if you're in a pub and says that, well, you know, if you're outnumbered in a pub, don't go up and be rude to someone, as if disproportionate response is somehow justified again. And that's I just don't believe it is. I just don't believe it is. I think that, you know, I mean, that was the good thing about Derek was the moment where the woman goes up and challenges two women because they've been talking about her friend and she's outnumbered, and that was the heartwarming moment in it. So it's bizarre that his public persona is so at odds with what he advances in his comedy, you know? It really bugs me that he sort of likens things to pubs and all, as if, you know, because he's really into the whole angle of punishing people. Oh, well, yeah, this is the thing. So he's talking about dealing with trolls as being a kind of self-defense, but self-defense, we don't tolerate self-defense when it becomes sadistic or when it becomes disproportionate. You know, if someone's trying to start a fight with you, you don't aim a tank into their face or take a sword to them. So again, it all comes down to a proportionate response.
Is rather unforgiving.
I think it is a fairly unforgiving medium because it is so gossipy, really, in a way. Everyone knows what's going on. You know, as soon as something starts kicking off, everyone's interested in finding out what's happening. So, yeah, I think it is an unforgiving medium, certainly.
Final question is, why can't everyone just be nice?
I wish we could, because sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's really hard. And we don't know what people are going through in their day-to-day lives. And that goes for the comedians, and that goes for the fans. So we've got to bear that in mind at all times. But why can't we all just be nice? Because we're human.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all have challenges that we face from day to day. And, I'm considering all the things I said about Twitter as well as being a medium that is perfect for expressing anger, short-term anger and rage and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Okay. Neil Kennedy from Cooks and Bonds and comedychat.co.uk. Thanks very much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me on the Pod Delusion, Tom.
No problem. This has been Tom Williamson for the Pod Delusion.
So that's what Neil thinks, but how should people handle the abuse they get online? Matt Greenfield this week has been wondering if we should just learn to live with it.
Stephen Moffat, showrunner of hit BBC shows Doctor Who and Sherlock, deleted his Twitter account in the wee hours of Sunday morning. Speculation is rife that his wordless departure from the microblogging service, on which he's usually quite active, is the result of receiving a particularly high number of vitriolic tweets in response to that evening's episode of Doctor Who. However, Moffat's wife and Sherlock co-producer Sue Virtue tweeted the following day that the Moffat's bowed out of Twitter due to a high workload from which he was being distracted. Nevertheless, his abrupt adieu has convinced many that he has capitulated to the trolls. Saturday's episode of Doctor Who, scriptively named Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, was watched by 5.5 million people according to overnight figures, beaten in the day's ratings only by ITV1's karaoke contest, The X Factor. Whilst press reviews of the episode were generally positive, fan reaction on Twitter was typically polarised, with some loving the Douglas Adams-style silliness of the adventure, while others felt that the less than demure reference to rape and the title character's merciless dealing with the villain were at odds with the usual tone of the show. Despite the episode actually being written by Chris Chibnall, whose credits include Life on Mars and whose spin-off Torchwood and the recent web miniseries Pond Life, Moffat is often presented as the face of New Who, Matt Smith notwithstanding. Even if Moffat's motivations for ditching Twitter really were productivity-related, and to be honest, we can all sympathise, the problem of Twitter trolls is one that's garnered a lot of attention lately. But first, a bit of housekeeping. The term troll originated as a way to describe a user who posted incendiary comments in forums solely to start an argument. More recently, it's been picked up by the press as a word used to describe people who send antagonistic messages specifically to users. If you're a purist and are insulted by my decision to employ the latter usage, I don't care. And also, while we can point to a number of instances where people have been arrested for sending threatening or racist tweets to public figures, and of course I don't want to underplay the importance of those cases, I'm instead going to focus on the non-threatening but nevertheless hurtful instances of just bullying on Twitter. Now, it would be naive to think that criticism didn't exist on the internet before Twitter came along. If you look in the right places, you can find Usenet posts from the mid-90s in which Stephen Moffat discusses Doctor Who with other fans, albeit long before he took the helm. Uniquely, Twitter promotes the idea that every thought and action can be reduced to a single sentence, which carries some inherent problems. The 140-character limit, though ostensibly trying to promote conciseness, often results in oversimplification, and otherwise innocuous or valid criticism can instead come off as brazen antagonism. What's more, the ability to include someone's Twitter screen name means that it's quite likely the target of your scorn will see what you said. Complaining about something with no feedback can understandably feel almost impotent. So people often want their criticisms to be noticed and recognised, and who better to give you that attention than the subject themselves? You don't have to include the username in your tweet, so why do so many of us do it? The sad result is analogous to mean world syndrome. No matter how much good feedback you get from other sources, the influx of negative tweets can be disheartening. Twitter allows you to detach yourself from seeing the impact that your tweet may make on an individual. So between this detachment and the necessary simplification that Twitter attracts, people must assume that they're being universally panned. When it reaches a crescendo, as no doubt it has for Moffat during the current series run of Doctor Who, it's no longer a vibrant community of fans to engage in discussion with and simply a delivery system for vitriol. But, as we heard in Tom's interview with Neil Kennedy, this can work both ways. Many celebrities will retweet particularly hurtful comments directed at them for all their followers to see. Whilst this tends to be a bit of harmless posturing as the subject's witty retort is given context, often this, inadvertently or not, will prompt others to leap to their defence. While celebrities, writers and public figures may have built up of such a thick skin they can brush it off, it may not be so easy for someone who's unaccustomed to such public antagonism. Just because someone dishes it out doesn't mean they necessarily have to take it. Factor in that the biggest age group on Twitter is under 18, so you end up with a lot of scorn being directed potentially at someone young enough to be easily upset by it. Though Moffat's catered other factors, being driven off Twitter by this type of mean world syndrome is hardly isolated. A good example came earlier this week when the former Sun editor Kelvin McKenzie came under fire for his coverage of the Hillsborough incident in 1989. Vigilante tweeters took up keyboards to tell Mr. McKenzie just what they thought of him. Except the former site editor doesn't own a Twitter account, and instead the vitriol was directed at an identically named 18-year-old. In this instance, nobody who tweeted in their disdain took the time to look at his profile and noticed it quite clearly wasn't a 65-year-old man depicted in the profile picture. Instead, the ability to quickly and blindly lob hatred at someone circumvented all else. But maybe there's a case to be made for simply learning to live with it. Many public figures have clearly learned to ignore, even laugh off, hateful comments thrown at them with the utmost grace. Jessica Ahlquist, who was shoved into the limelight for having the courage to challenge her school's overly religious practices, is, for someone of her age, very good at handling the horrendous things she gets tweeted on a daily basis. With the internet, it seems as though the only prerequisite for being criticised is existing, so maybe we should accept it as an unavoidable side effect and learn to ignore it. And whilst that sounds practical, the next logical step of that is to say that anyone incapable of handling the scorn shouldn't be online in the first place, which, of course, would be incredibly unfair. In my work as a tech journalist, a lot of the sites I write for have comment sections which frequently turn into a soapbox of people who disagree with me. I would be one of the first to admit that I don't have a particularly thick skin for this stuff, so does that mean I have stopped doing a job that I like? The if you can't handle the heat, get out of the kitchen mentality is fairly myopic in practice. For Twitter's own business interests, something has to be done. If Twitter becomes overrun with trolls, then nobody wants to engage in an environment where their every word is met with a disproportionate amount of vitriol from people just looking for an argument. Paradoxically, if Twitter tries to change its terms of service to make it easy to block trolls, then they'll create an overly sensitive environment where the lightest word, taken the wrong way, could get them thrown off. Now, I'm just naive enough to think that very few people mean to be purposely incendiary, so perhaps the solution, as woolly as this may sound, is for Twitter to promote basic consideration when tweeting someone. Of course, there will always be people looking for an argument, trolls in the more classic sense of the word, but they'll become much easier to brush off and ignore if they become a rarity. This sounds idealistic, of course, but it seems to be the only sensible solution. If we promote consideration, if we take a moment before hitting the tweet button to remember that these are real people we're messaging, to weigh up if our critiques are valid or just born out of spur-of-the-moment emotion, to bear in mind if they need to be told this or if we're just looking for attention, and how our tweet may be received when we're limited to 140 characters, we can try to make a concerted effort to make things online just that little bit friendlier if we take a little bit of consideration. Like I say, it's idealistic and it's woolly, but I think it's worth a try. This is Matt Greenfield for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, you may remember back in June on episode 140 when we had philosopher and atheist horseman Dan Dennett on the show. Well, we've got a bit of a treat for you as Deborah Hyde, who's the editor of The Skeptic magazine, who interviewed him for us, has held a bit back so we could broadcast it to coincide with Dennett appearing in the magazine. So here's a bit more of a very clever man saying some very clever things.
So, thank you, Daniel Dennett, for speaking to us. What's it like being a horseman? When did you first even hear that term?
I don't know who started the four horsemen term, but then after it had been used quite a bit, when the four of us were all together at an atheist convention of some, I can't remember exactly which one it was, but it was in Washington, D.C., we all met at Christopher Hitchens' wonderful apartment, and Richard Dawkins had a professional video crew there to videotape the conversation between the four of us, and that video has been out there for now some years, and that was called The Four Horsemen, I think. So it's been I think the main thing I dislike about it is that there are another four or six or eight or ten really articulate, clever, original atheists out there who aren't considered one of the horsemen and or woman. And it has left them a bit in the shade in a way that's unfortunate, because they deserve just as much attention or more.
And let us know a couple of your favorites in that list.
Oh, well, there's Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was supposed to be there at the first meeting. She was called away back to Holland on a sort of crisis. So she was supposed to be, there was supposed to be five of us in the first place. And there's, there's Lawrence Krauss and Victor Stenger and Jerry Coyne. And, I could go on and on, but I...
There's a lot of good work out there.
Yeah.
Richard Dawkins describes you as the most human of the so-called horsemen, and your books could be characterised, I certainly find them, as elegant and reasonable rather than polemic. Yet you wrote a wonderful piece about the value of rudeness. You recounted a public speaking event where you said Christopher Hitchens awoke you from your diplomatic slumbers.
Yes.
And it's an issue that freethinkers and atheists face constantly. We have to tread between being insipid and being wanton values. Where do you put that line?
Well, it's impossible to say where that line is in advance, because there's always going to be people out there who want to exploit any line you draw by sort of pushing right up against it to see what they can get away with. But the fact is that for hundreds of years, actually, religious apologists have honed their craft of apologetics, of basically propaganda for their religious views, and they are very deft at the blandishments, the lulling, the gulling, and in particular, making the listener feel guilty for skepticism, and creating this aura of reverence around whatever they say. And we have to break that down. That's we have to level the playing field. And if some interlocutors see that and behave reasonably and fine and don't take offense or don't play the faith card or the reverence card, and good for them, then we can all be calm and polite and have a proper conversation. But for those who are basically religious bullies, well, when you face a religious bully, you've got to bully back. You've got to be rude.
Well, I remember you saying in Breaking the Spell, you quoted Durkheim and Eliade and accused them of effectively religious protectionism,
exactly.
Saying that you can't apply outside.
Yeah, I think that's baloney. Yeah. We wouldn't stand for that in any other area of controversy.
No.
We wouldn't say, oh, if you don't have, you know, a degree from the Harvard Business School, you really are in no position to criticize businessmen. Hogwash. So we should simply, that line of protectionism, we should dismiss as just not even worthy of discussion.
And in fact, you're very explicit in Breaking the Spell that you're not trying to break the spell of religious belief, you're trying to break the spell around talking about religion.
That's right. This protectionism, this hyper-respect, when I'm asked, when I'm accused of being, or when any of the four horsemen are accused of being, you know, aggressive and rude, I ask, well, if they were talking about big oil or Wall Street or big pharmaceuticals, would you think that was out of place? Was this too aggressive? No. Well, religions are big institutions. They have a huge budget. They wield a lot of power, and any human institution that has that kind of power deserves to be treated with as much respect as is there to, and not a bit more.
In fact, looking at Western civilization, I suppose, over the last few hundred years, we've gone through phases of approaching religion, from it being self-evidently even dangerous to question, to it being anti-enlightenment and downgraded, possibly to a sign of intellectual inadequacy. And you're part of a new movement that you say religious isn't an unnatural act, so we're on to the next phase, seeing as it as an emergent property of our own nature and functions, a natural phenomenon.
Natural is a term that often carries connotations of it's good because it's natural. Well, you know, disease is natural too. You know, myopia is natural. Violence is natural. But, of course, religion is a natural phenomenon in the sense, the neutral sense. And it's also a natural phenomenon in the sense that it comes easily to most people, and that's not a coincidence. It's been designed over the eons to be, as it were, user-friendly in some ways, to lure people in, to make them comfortable and adept, even to make them, in a certain degree, addicted to their religion, so that they feel... they have withdrawal symptoms if they don't get their weekly dose of religion.
Well, it certainly serves a useful purpose for many people, doesn't it?
It does, and I think it's important to acknowledge that, and acknowledge that for many, many people, religion is the protective shell that permits them to live a secure and not painful life. Those of us who are lucky to have lots of friends and good jobs
health.
And good health should remind ourselves that there's a lot of people that are down on their luck and are really quite desperate, or would be quite desperate would be unbelievably alone and in despair if they didn't have a church that they could belong to. Churches are very good at taking in people and giving them dignity and something to do that's helpful.
It's an indication, I suppose, of the kind of institutions that we could usefully invent in a secular space to do the same thing.
In fact, I often insist that we really are obliged to replace religions with secular institutions which can pick up the slack on some of those jobs.
The latest issue of The Skeptic magazine has just been printed, so we'll be hitting subscribers' doorsteps shortly. You can find links to find out more about the magazine on the Pod Delusion website. And that's just about it for this week's show. Before we go, don't forget our massive event in London, which is taking place tomorrow. That's Saturday, September the 15th, so do come along if you're free on Saturday evening to Conway Hall near Holborn in central London. Tickets on the door will be £7, or you can still buy them online if you're super quick. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website, you can listen to 3 years' worth of archives, as well as follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and all that sort of thing. And of course, if you do head over to our website, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. Go on, it's like buying us a couple of drinks a month. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Trish Han, Alex Fitch, Salim Fadley, Tom Williamson, Matt Greenfield, Deborah Hyde, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Hello, are you with the archaeological team?
Yes, indeed I am.
Well, I'm here from the Leicestershire Gazette, just following up on the discovery of the skeleton of Richard III.
Oh, of course. Very exciting indeed.
So, what can you tell me about the find?
Well, we've had information for some time that Richard's burial place was in a friary that's since been built over with his council car park. We finally got the opportunity to dig, and to our amazement, we were able to unearth a skeleton which we believe to be Richard himself.
And how do you know that?
The curvature of the spine, the placement of wounds, and the remains had a fairly tatty pair of slippers, which suggests he died during a winter of discontent. Of course, we have now extracted the DNA in order to test our findings.
So how are you going to use that DNA?
We can use it to test against his descendants, but actually, there's a faster way.
And this is why all the scaffolding's been erected around the site? It looks like you're building some sort of friary-based visitor attraction.
Well, it worked in films, so we combined the skeleton DNA with frog DNA.
You don't mean...
I do. Welcome to Monastic Park.
Good grief! Is that a 40-foot-tall Richard III?
It is, and we should move. It's feeding time for the massive monarch.
A horse, my kingdom for a horse, and chips.
But why do you need to create this at all? Surely the find was enough.
Oh, you'd think so, but once the council worked out how long the body had lain under one of the bays, they charged us for 527 years parking. I pointed out he was disabled, but he didn't have a badge.
And how much are they looking for?
Ironically, a king's ransom.
Oh, no wonder he had the hump.